And then the last case of the day is Lawrence versus Commandant. This is 23055. And we'll hear from the appellant. Okay, we'll hear from the appellant.
Can you hear me now, Your Honor?
Yes.
Okay, good. And also, I just want to make sure you can see me too. Okay,
we can.
Thank you very kindly. May it please the court. My name is John Maher, and I'm here on behalf of plaintiff appellant Clint Lawrence, formerly of the 82nd Airborne Division, who spent 6 years in the United States Disciplinary Barracks on Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And on November 15th, 2019, the President of the United States issued him a full and unconditional pardon. This morning, he's completing his first year of law school. And so I'm very happy to bring that to the court's attention. I'd like to begin my presentation just by briefly going over to some of the facts that gave rise to the court-martial and what we believe is a separation of powers challenge, which is properly before the court today. Briefly, by way of background, in July 2012, Lieutenant Lawrence was leading a combat patrol of 82nd Airborne Infantry officers and non-commissioned officers through Kandahar Province when three motorcycle riders approached them on the same vehicle. Two of the American officers up front opened fire. The American strike at the Afghan National Army opened fire. And then Lawrence, who did not see the target, gave the order to fire. Then two of the riders were killed. A third escaped. And that gave rise to the two murder convictions and the attempted murder conviction, basically the gravamen of that conversation. Our firm came on the case after the appeal, or after the trial for the appeal, the Article I military appeal through the Army Court of Criminal Appeals and the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. And during our investigation, we uncovered what we believe to be 8 to 10 material Brady violations where the United States prosecution had in its possession, custody, or control footage of three fighting-aged, military-aged males armed with AK-47 cross assault rifles, that the DNA and fingerprints were taken from at least some of the Afghan men on that field that day, which left their fingerprint and DNA on bomb parts. And on top of that, there was a blimp operator in the sky, an aerostat operator, who made a report and also captured video footage of Lawrence's platoon being, as he wrote, scouted for an impending ambush or attack. Prior to this incident, Lawrence has no disciplinary problems with his prior 10 years in the Army, where he made staff sergeant, a non-commissioned officer, and then was selected for the Army's coveted Green to Gold program, where they sent him to college. Well, he was convicted, and one of the things that his defense counsel never brought out at trial was the fact that several of those soldiers who testified against Lawrence received murder allegations themselves and were then given grants of immunity in order to testify against Lawrence, and the jury never knew. Through the military Article One system involved mainly Fifth Amendment due process claims under Brady, as well as Sixth Amendment Strickland v. Washington ineffective assistance of counsel claims. Once we've exhausted the appeals through the Article One system, we had no relief. Kansas dismissed this initially, but then we were able to refile it to characterize it correctly as a prosecutorial misconduct claim.
Mr. Maher, could you back up? We're going to give you a little bit of additional time, but you know, this is, we're hearing a little, it's cutting in and out a little bit.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Pretty well, it's not your fault, but we want to hear everything you have to say. So if you can back up maybe just about a minute of what you were saying, and then, because I didn't
okay. hear all of that. Okay, Your Honor, I'll try to move closer to the device here, if that's better. But once we, our case was filed under 28 U.S.C. Section 2241 as a collateral attack of a court-martial conviction before the Article III jurists in the District of Kansas. The case was dismissed, and we were given permission to reply and refile, the idea being to couch our prosecutorial misconduct claim into a due process claim. which is what we did. 4 days later, the President of the United States issued a full and unconditional pardon for Lieutenant Lawrence, and then the United States moved to dismiss. Coming forward, that dismissal was based upon the Wavetops being that the pardon not only rendered the case or claims moot, but also waived Lieutenant Lawrence's challenges to his ongoing convictions. We respectfully disagree, and we wrote our papers, and that's what brings us here before you this morning. And to turn to the specifics of what we believe the United States might be doing to misinterpret the law is there's no firm language. If you go through the United States' briefs, there's no specific black letter language that says acceptance of a pardon confesses guilt. Instead, there is some case law and language out there that says acceptance of a pardon may imply guilt. Also, the Justice Department's Office of the Pardon Attorney has sent information to Lieutenant Lawrence saying, quote unquote, that acceptance of the pardon does not imply innocence. So all of that to say, I think that in our study of the issue, that most people who are going to receive a federal pardon have been found guilty of something. So that might be where that language comes in, may imply rather than gives rise to a confession of.
Does it matter what he was informed of? And of course, what I'm speaking to is the November 19th, 2019 letter from the acting pardon attorney that says, advises Mr. Lawrence, a presidential pardon is a sign of forgiveness. It does not erase or expunge the record of conviction and does not indicate innocence.
Yes, Judge, and I think that's very relevant on the second point here where the lower court missed, and that is this case is no longer moot. This case is not moot. There are many. Lieutenant Lawrence has many stakeholders, personal stakeholders, where right now, if he graduates from law school, he's still going to have those records of conviction. Moreover, he still has challenges with veterans benefits. On top of that, he has a dismissal, which is an officer's dishonorable discharge from the service, and that's never going away. That's ineradicable stigma in the lines of the case law. So those things are still very much afforded, and the president's pardon does not take away from that at all. The president's pardon forgives the criminality and restores some civil liberties, but had the president proceeded under a statutory grant of authority rebriefed, which did not get into the courtroom, and that statutory grant would have provided the relief we still think that the lower court can provide under 28 U.S.C. 2243, and that is to adjudicate the case as justice requires. And so to take a step back, and I hope this is not too convoluted, I hope I'm being clear, Your Honors, but in addition to the Article II pardon power, the President of the United States has been vested with two specific and additional statutory powers where the Congress created in him the ability to be a general court martial convening authority, and then secondly, to disapprove all findings and sentences, except nowadays for some sexual assault cases. So that was the first tack we took to say, Mr. President, if you and your team and your staffers believe that this case, based upon unjust convictions, which is also the language of 28 U.S.C. Section 1495, that you can proceed to sue the United States government for an unjust conviction. If you believe that to be the case, this case could be deserving to disapprove the findings in the sentence, which would then have restored Lieutenant Lawrence to the status quo ante before his court-martial, to include all those years he spent in prison towards a valuable military retirement, promotions, back pay and lost privileges, as well as being restored to veterans benefits as he moves out into the world. Now, the United States, by and through its papers, tried to distinguish seeking those two alternative forms of relief as that we totally knew that a pardon would not fully erase or expunge. And that is the case. But we were providing the exact accomplish this if you disapprove the findings in the sentence under the two statutes, or you can return Lawrence home, send him It says my connection's unstable. Can you gentlemen hear me?
Wait, you're Blake?
I can hear him okay. Can you, Judge Reveal?
Well, yes, I can hear you, although you are cutting in and out a little bit every now and then, but only briefly.
I'm so sorry, Your Honor. I beg your pardon. I don't want to put my whole face in the screen, but in any event, with regard to the pardon, that was our alternative request, considering that if you read the president's unfettered and plenary power authority over federal offenses, that still left Lieutenant Lawrence before the United States District Courts, the federal jurists appointed upon life and good behavior, who are the experts in this area of the law, and 28 U.S.C. Section 2243 says the only remedy is not ordering a new trial. The only remedy, there's, you can do as a jurist whatever the law and justice require. So that's why, because these very real stakes are alive for Lieutenant Lawrence, so much so that he is experiencing what the case law calls collateral consequences. And there's a Supreme Court case we filed in our appellate brief called Callis, I believe it is, which lays it out and saying this case is still very much alive. So those were our approaches here. So in an abundance of caution, on the one hand, because he could disapprove the findings in the sentence and return Lawrence status quo ante with the effect of an expungement, return his back pay, put him back on duty, and or if they wanted to try him again, they could do that as well, potentially. By contrast with the pardon we believe would see him free and be exonerated from what we believe to be unlawful and unjust incarceration, then he would be able to rejoin his legal team here and continue the fights in the Article III courts of the United States to say, I still have a dismissal. The case law says any office I forfeit will not be returned. I still have the back pay. I have the ineradicable stigma of dishonor for the rest of my days, all at the hands of what we believe to be substantial Brady violations coupled with substantial Strickland violations.
When you say they could potentially retry him, expound on that.
Well, Your Honor, for example, in the lower court's decision, and I also believe in Mr. Mogg's papers before this court, they talk about an unenviable position of the commandant would not have an advantage, or worse to that effect, and I'm paraphrasing. However, what we think is the commandant and the Justice Department, we're both all former justice lawyers in my firm, that you're vindicating an American right. You're administering a statute. So whether or not there's an advantage, that's not necessarily the right answer. Instead, what the right answer is, give him a trial where Brady applies. Give him a trial where Strickland applies. And if that's something that remains viable, proceed with it. However, the court here before it has the authority under Section 28 U.S.C. 2243 to rule as justice may require. So what we would ask you to do is send it back to the district judge.
You're not saying the pardon would prevent a retrial?
Oh, the pardon, yes, sir. The pardon would prevent a retrial on those offenses for which he was specifically pardoned.
You're saying the pardon would prevent a retrial. Is that what you're saying? Or are you saying it would present a retrial? Which? Can he have a retrial?
Prevent. I beg your pardon, Judge, if I was breaking up there.
Then where's the case or controversy?
And there's two cases that we cite in our paper. Well, the case or controversy, Your Honor, is that Lawrence is still laboring under the debilitating effects of the overreaching of the prosecution. That's still very much alive. His dismissal will stay with him forever. His back pay will never be paid to him.
So you're asking,
he has presented.
You're saying he cannot be retried, but you are saying now we want to be able to pursue our litigation for additional non-criminal remedies because of this trial. Is that correct?
Well, if I follow your logic there, Your Honor, these are non-criminal remedies. These are criminal remedies directly stemming from the punishment imposed by the court-martial. So they are criminal remedies. And they haven't been cleaned up by the president's pardon.
I I am confused. What is it that you want to, you can't get civil remedies unless you prove that you were vindicated from the criminal trial. And the question could be whether the pardon does or doesn't do that. That's not really what you focused on in your briefs. You're not saying you can get retried. You don't want to get retried. You're saying
no, Judge, we don't.
That's that. So if you can't get civil remedies because you, or do you say you can get civil remedies because you have ultimately prevailed, and that's what you are seeking? And I mean, I thought that the only issue in this case was whether accepting the pardon resulted in a waiver, basically, of the ability to seek civil remedies because you had conceded guilt.
And we, that is an issue, Judge, but we disagree with it. There is no concession of guilt. Clint Lawrence pled not guilty all along, and in none of our papers have we ever said that he's accepting guilt.
That's the issue, but you said that is an issue or a issue. Are there other issues that I'm missing in this case, or isn't that the only issue?
No, Judge. I think the other issue that Judge Phillips brought up was the idea that there is a case or controversy component here that the United States disagrees with. But we respectfully disagree with their assertion, because when you have lingering collateral consequences, in the words of the case law, affecting a soldier into his or her civilian life, you still have Article III jurisprudence or jurisdiction. And I see that my time is severely over limit.
Judge Bell, do you have any additional questions?
No.
Okay. Judge Phillips, do you?
Well, I guess I do have one, which is, say you prevail on the Strickland and on the Brady, then what? Typically, there would be something that followed that, like another trial.
Ordinarily, but what we've seen in the military, Your Honor, is lots of times if we were to prevail on those kinds of things, there wouldn't be another trial, or there would be some sort of administrative separation that would probably be a follow-on.
Okay. Did you have any follow-up, Judge Phillips?
No, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. You're out of time, but I am going to give you, and if you can strictly observe this, one minute for rebuttal. Okay. Mr. Mack, we'd like to hear from the appellee, please.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Jared Magg on behalf of the respondent, the commandant of the United States Disciplinary Barracks. Let me start by saying that it is unequivocally true that the defendant or that the petitioner can never be retried in this case. There's absolutely nothing that the government can do in the event that he were to prevail, if this court were to send this back. And to answer Judge Phillips' question directly, what would happen next? There's nothing that would happen next. The government has absolutely no recourse here whatsoever if the court sends this back. As it were, if the court were to authorize the petitioner to move forward, the government simply goes along for the ride in an attempt to try to prove that the military courts had gave full and fair consideration of his case. But at the end of the day, there is absolutely no recourse for the government in the event that the lower court or this court were to find that the military courts did not give full or fair consideration to his claims. And that is black letter law.
I'm thinking of an analogy. If there had been a direct appeal, just assume it's a civil case, a criminal case, but not in the civilian court, not in the military courts. And he was convicted. And he got the conviction overturned, and the Court of Appeals said the government didn't have enough evidence, so you are determined not guilty, and you can't be retried. And then he said, okay, now I would like also, though, to go back and various things happened in that trial that I thought were not proper. Wouldn't we just simply say that that's all moot? Not because you have conceded guilt in the appeal, because you haven't conceded guilt, but simply because there cannot be another trial, period. It has nothing to do with whether you've conceded guilt or not.
Well, as I understand your question, Judge Bell, this case doesn't present a case of insufficient evidence. There was certainly sufficient evidence to convict. The question here is whether or not there were some evidentiary matters that were under consideration. So in the event that the court were to ever reverse on this case, it would simply be to determine whether or not the Brady, the alleged Brady issues were really important enough to be presented at the new trial, whether or not that evidence had to have been presented. There is not a structural error issue, nor is there a sufficiency of the evidence. No, I can't agree with your hypothetical.
I'm not arguing any of that. The briefing largely focused on whether accepting the pardon was a admission of guilt. But I'm wondering if that's really the issue, because whether or not it was an admission of guilt, this case is over. It cannot be retried. And so is there a continuing case or controversy about the procedures? And what is the remaining case or controversy? Let's assume it's not an admission of guilt. The case is still over and it cannot be retried.
That's correct. We know at bottom that the case cannot be retried. But our fundamental position is that because, as the court said in verdict, the acceptance of a pardon is an imputation of guilt or a confession to it, that the defendant cannot move forward under two tracks here. He cannot say that I'm not guilty of the offense and I want to be retried, but at the same time, I am agreeing that I'm guilty of this offense because I've accepted the pardon.
Why not? Can a guilty man or woman not get collateral relief because he or she committed the crime, even if the government can't constitutionally prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt?
I think that's a very difficult argument for a defendant to make a valid point in front of the court when they're trying to establish that they're in fact not guilty of the offense. And that's exactly why this was a
defendants
binary.
Defendants do that successfully all of the time, saying, yes, I had drugs, but it was unconstitutional. We just heard one a little bit ago. There was a challenged 922G convictions that are felons in possession of a firearm, but they claim that it was unconstitutionally seized. Drug defendants do that constantly. In Tillett versus Henderson, the Supreme Court didn't say that someone can't challenge a guilty plea because somebody is guilty. The Supreme Court said, no, there is a specific disruption in the proceedings that create a disconnect between the constitutional violation, the unconstitutional convening of a grand jury, and the adjudication, that the guilty plea constitutes a disruption. So I'm not sure. I think you have a strong argument under Burdick that this is an imputation or confession of guilt. I'm just not sure why that necessarily precludes someone from collaterally challenging a conviction.
I don't know that it necessarily does in that context, but it does here when the executive profoundly impacts the proceedings by reaching in and saying, I'm going to go ahead and issue the pardon in this case. So government, you get to no longer have any recourse for you. I'm going to then force you to go ahead and litigate this case. But if you lose, there's really nothing for you in the end. And so it profoundly impacts how the case or controversy proceeds. And that's really what Judge Lundstrom was talking about, is there's no opportunity for this to move forward in the more traditional context of a case or controversy, because at the end of the day, the parties are so profoundly impacted by the executive's authority to issue the pardon in this case that it disrupts the proceedings significantly.
Well, you have a strong argument if this were before King Solomon that this is unfair, because what President Trump did would have been precluding the government from recharging him, even if he obtained a conditional writ of habeas corpus. So maybe it's unfair, but this is obviously not King Solomon. What doctrine? Mootness, waiver, whatever. I mean, there's no doctrine of fairness. What doctrine would preclude him from collaterally challenging his conviction because of the inequity of him being able to collaterally challenge the conviction and the government not being able to successfully re-prosecute him?
Well, we know that the court in Carafas versus LaFell talk about the ability for a respondent to move forward or a petitioner to move forward and challenge any of the collateral consequences after they leave custody. But that's different here because the defendant or the petitioner here has, we believe, again, holding back on Burdick, but the petitioner's decision to go ahead and accept that pardon is an imputation of guilt. And this gets to the question of his binary choice. He had a choice to reject this, to go ahead and allow this case to proceed in the traditional fashion in an Article III court where the lower court is not in any way impeded on how it can, in fact, rule on the case. And I think the strong point, and to maybe get directly to your point, Judge Baccarat, the lower court has no power to alter the defendant's or the petitioner's sentence here. And because his sentence is no longer based upon his military conviction, his sentence is now based upon the Article II decision to grant him a pardon. So there is no sentence. There is no habeas, traditional habeas sentence or habeas action to impact a sentence that was issued by the military courts because that no longer exists.
Why does it matter? Because he's not challenging the sentence. The Brady challenge is with regard to the conviction. It's not a sentence. It wouldn't have been a sentence challenge had he not been pardoned.
In the habeas context, a petitioner is always challenging the conviction and the sentence itself. So at the end of the day, but I don't know that that is a distinction with much of a difference here because the lower court could not in any way impact the actual conviction itself in the event that it wishes to go ahead and grant him relief because he cannot, the lower court cannot send anything back to the military courts under any circumstance whatsoever.
Well, there is such a thing as an unconditional writ of habeas corpus. Now, you know, district courts have discretion to grant a conditional writ, but there's nothing to prohibit a court from saying, I'm granting you, Mr. Lawrence, a writ of habeas corpus. You are hereby released. The conviction is invalid and you are not to be re-prosecuted.
I understand that. That's absolutely true. But you see that mostly in the context of a structural error, where the error was so significant that the petitioner cannot be retried, nor should he be retried. That is not the situation here. I can't think of a case where you have a Brady violation or an attendant ineffective assistance of counsel claim that would not be sent back to the lower courts for determination as to whether or not the error was so significant that retrial could not be had. The lower court has no option here. They cannot send it back. So essentially, the government is left to to move forward and go along for the ride, understanding that it has one track here. It's on a one-way street. There just is no opportunity for any traditional case or controversy to exist, as it were, if this were to be sent back to the lower court. And that's, again, what Judge Longstrom, I believe, was really concerned with, was that there was just no opportunity for a traditional case or controversy. Now, if this lends itself to the question about whether or not there is an imputation of guilt, again, we firmly believe that if the court were to find that that is somewhat irrelevant, it hollows out the pardon process. The whole pardon process and the ability to reject the pardon is there for a reason, because if the individual who knows that a pardon does not absolve them of the underlying offense itself, then the only way to completely absolve that is through the Article III courts, at least in the federal context. And that is where the rights are vindicated, is in the Article III context. And without that opportunity, or in this case, giving the petitioner the opportunity to vindicate his rights in the Article III context, at the same time, affirming, at least through Burdick, that in fact he is guilty of the offense by acknowledging the acceptance of the pardon, again, hollows out the process itself and turns the pardon process into really just a ministerial act. Why would anybody reject a pardon if they could continue to litigate? That would absolutely render the pardon process null and void, and quite frankly, it lends itself to an abuse of the pardon process. Under those circumstances, because it really does not give the individual the opportunity to make that binary choice under those circumstances, because why would you not accept it? if you can continue to litigate. And the government has absolutely no recourse under those circumstances. And again, as the in the case or controversy context, the Supreme Court has always
The government has some recourse. I mean, they could have made the pardon conditioned. I mean, can't presidents make pardons conditioned?
Absolutely, could
have made a condition that this is conditioned upon your agreeing not to bring any actions against the government as a result of these charges. But the president chose not to do that or didn't do it. It's not like the poor government doesn't have any recourses in future events.
Well, we have the only recourse we have is to continue to defend the military court's decisions and whether or not they gave full and fair consideration. That's all the government can do. But again, as Judge Lungstrom appreciated, in the event that the court were to find that the courts did not give full and fair consideration, the litigation ends. And I don't know of a case that would establish that a case or controversy exists when one party is really hamstrung in the process itself and has no recourse under the circumstances. Because again, if Judge Lungstrom finds for any reason that the petitioner's argument has some ground for relief and decides that it is not structural error of some sort and decides it wishes to send it back, it has nowhere to send it to. There's nowhere for the case to go under those circumstances. And when you look at the case law and case
for controversy, it's just not intuitive to the government. Can you stop me from it? I'm not sure that it's right that the government has no recourse. I mean, if there are collateral consequences, such as the freeing up for the defendant the ability to claim pensions or payment while he was incarcerated, or to be eligible for other military benefits, VA hospitals or so forth. If the government decides there are other benefits, the government, you don't have the option to re-prosecute him, but I would think you would still have motivation and the ability to proceed in litigation that challenges the underlying conviction, which is exactly what he wants to do, because you do have interests involved.
Well, we certainly have interests to, at least at this level, from the purposes of what the Department of Justice must do in these circumstances, is to establish that the lower military courts gave full and fair consideration. But that is our interest. The defendant or the petitioner's interest himself, while he has achieved had some of his civil rights given back to him, some of the other attendant military rights, he, as Judge Lungstrom talked about, can attempt to appeal to the administrative agencies to try to undo those. But at the end of the day, the government's position all along has been that once petitioner decides to accept a pardon, which he can reject, and upon rejection can continue to vindicate his rights in an Article III court. But when the executive reaches down and pardons an individual during that process, it so fundamentally impairs the government's ability to move forward under case or controversy that the petitioner's decision understandably renders the case moot. And unless the court has any further questions, I see that I'm over my time.
Judge Abell, do you have any additional questions?
No.
Judge Phillips, do you?
No.
Okay. I gave Mr. Mayor 1 minute. So if you can be careful to not exceed 1 minute. You're on mute. You're still on mute.
How about that? All right. Thank you for your patience, Your Honors. And just to speak to some of the conversation and some of the substance that went on this afternoon about the effect of acceptance or rejection of a pardon, I'd just like to bring to the court's attention page 12 of our reply brief, where we devote a paragraph to Major Matthew Goldstein, U.S. Army Special Forces. He was pardoned the same day that Lawrence was, but he had not yet gone to trial. So surely, logically extrapolating, his acceptance of a pardon would not be a confession of guilt. Secondly, with regard to the long-lasting and collateral effects that Judge Ebel mentioned, I'd like to cite to the court, also on page 12 of our reply brief, Carafas v. LaValle, 391 U.S. 234, which basically states habeas petition is not moot as long as petitioner suffers collateral consequences. Those are pretty well settled. So all of that to say, gentlemen, I know my time is about to expire, and I certainly appreciate the court's indulgence.
Thank you, counsel. Both of you, it was very well presented in your written submissions and today, and we appreciate your hard work. This matter will be taken under submission.